Well, it is that time of year again. The time when Christmas spoil sports come out in full force. You know, the people who want us to say happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas. It's the people running around trying to sue any city hall that still has the guts to put a nativity scene on public property. But this year, the Christmas cranks have taken it to a whole new level. They've actually launched an ad campaign to try to convince us that God doesn't exist. And furthermore, that we don't actually need God to be good. The Humanist Association has paid for some posters to be posted on buses in Washington, D.C. And the ad features a skinny Santa with dreadlocks and the words, "Why believe in a God? Just be good for goodness sake." You see, in the past couple years, atheists have really been ramping up the attack on God. Not like this is a new thing. I don't want you to start thinking, wow, people are attacking God. That's been going on as long as there's been people and God. But they've really been ramping it up, and it's taking a new twist that I want to point out for you this morning that I hope you can help you as we seek to defend our faith and joyfully live it out. And not be intimidated. I don't expect to turn us all into armed militants that are going to win the day. I just want you to not be intimidated. Don't be intimidated and continue being joyful and living it out. It's hard to contradict a true Christian who's living it out, who's living Christ. The past couple years, atheists have really been ramping it up with books like Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great. Now, that's different. You know, they're just getting a little more bold, a little more direct. The God Delusion and God Is Not Great. Or just a couple of the recent examples. These are not the only ones that have found themselves on the bestseller list. Big-making bestsellers. But when you read them, here's what I think is interesting. And I bought both these books. Now, I'll admit I didn't read the whole thing word for word. I couldn't stomach it. And I had other things I wanted to use my time for. But I have skimmed through both these books and read parts of them. And what I think is interesting is what you'll start to see now is Richard Dawkins is really not doing that much research in science anymore. He's a propagandist. He's a crusader on a cause. And he's crusading for the cause of life without a God. Much more than a scientist and anyone doing research now, he's a crusader. He's promoting and crusading for life without God. So his books and interviews now, when you read them, when you listen to him, they're much more filled with propaganda, half-truths, exaggerations, and slander against God than they are with any real research or science. It's almost like he doesn't have anything new to say, so he just tries to slam Christianity, slam God. No new research and science really in these books. So what is behind this continual assault on God and the ads that would be on the buses this Christmas season? Well, Fred Edwards, the communications director for the Humanist Association, says this. He said, quote, "We are just trying to plant a seed of rational thought, critical thinking, and questioning in people's minds." Well, you know what? I want to go on record here publicly this morning in saying thank you, Fred Edwards. Thank you. Thank you, Humanist Association, really. Because without realizing it, the Humanist Association has done us a great big favor this year with the ad campaign. You see, most years the typical American just slogs through the Christmas season from Thanksgiving to January 1st, eating, drinking, consuming loads of sugar, watching football, stressing out, standing in lines to return unwanted gifts. But this year, anybody that sees one of those ads splashed on the side of one of those buses is going to have to stop and think about God and think about good. They're going to be forced to think about what the real issue even is at Christmas time that sometimes gets lost. Thank you. They paid for it. And it's going to help us. It's going to punch through the tinsel and the songs and the blah, blah, blah and the Santa Claus and the elves and make them think about, oh, yeah, God. And, oh, yeah, can we be good? Is there good? So, yes, I do hope people stop and think critically and rationally and begin to start to question the basis of their own morality and the existence of God. You see, what the Humanist Association has done is they've brought into sharp focus and zoomed in for us one of the biggest problems with throwing out God. They're highlighting the biggest problem of life without God. And here it is. Without God, can we have a safety net of moral fabric and justice and protection from evil that every human being longs for, every human heart longs for and wants this safety net of moral fabric, justice, protection from evil? Without God, can we have peace, security, and a sense of order? Especially those that are raising kids or have grandkids, there's just something happens to the human heart. You want to know that there is some kind of safety net. Is there a distinction between good and evil? Is there good? Is there order? Is it going to be okay? It's not just Christians that have those thoughts. It's human beings that have those thoughts. Without God, the nagging question is, without God, will there be good? And without God, can we be good? Because God and good go together. We learn that in the very little classes. They're back there singing that now. God is so good. God and good go together. We know that. God and good. When you rip out God, can we still have good? Can we still have God? Regardless of your thoughts one way or another about the existence of God, most people living today still want to live in a society that has some sense of moral right and wrong, some sense of justice and equity, some distinction between good and evil, and some protection from it. But as soon as you flush the whole concept of God, you're left with nagging, unanswered questions. How do we even know that good really exists? And who's going to define what good is? Your definition of good might differ widely from someone else's definition of good. And your concept of good just might start to trample all over my concept of good and turn out to actually be really bad for me in the long run. You see where that's headed? If everyone defines it for themselves? How are you going to sort that out? What's good? You say, oh, Brad, I don't think that's ever going to happen. We're too sophisticated, intellectual. We've made such modern advances. That's never going to happen. One person's sense of good trampling all over someone else's sense of good. Really? Read the news. Look at world history. Think just for a minute with me. Adolf Hitler thought it was good to produce a pure race of Aryans and to exterminate Jews, gypsies, and anyone else that got in his way. And folks, I'm not talking Hollywood here. That's not a movie like Independence Day or The End of the World. As horrific as it is when you read the history of what took place, this is not Hollywood. This was history, and it didn't happen 500 years ago when we were barbarians dragging our women around by the hair and just snorting and eating raw meat. This was just 75 years ago, folks. 75 years ago, this took place. And guess who Hitler was reading? Charles Darwin and Nietzsche. We're nothing but bigger-brained animals, survival of the fittest, and God is dead. Nietzsche was the first one to coin that phrase. And that's what that kind of thinking leads to. Ideas have consequences, and life without God has serious consequences if you buy into that, if you believe that. But even then, if we can come up with a common definition of good, and we can all agree, you're still not done. You're still not done. Even if we could agree on a common definition of good, here's the real kicker. What makes you think you can do it? You can keep it. You can consistently be what we all decide is our definition of good. Apart from God and left to ourselves, let's be honest. Look back over your shoulder at the history of mankind. Do we have a track record of being good to each other? No. No, 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 no. So now, do you feel the problem? Have I thrown a blanket over your little Christmas spirit maybe that you had? Do you feel the problem? Do you feel the tension? I hope so. And here's why. Because Christmas is all about a problem. Christmas is all about a problem. And I'm not talking about that problem of what to buy that person that has everything. People think that's such a big problem. We got bigger problems than that. The problem, Christmas addresses our greatest problem, our biggest problem. Christmas is all about what God in His mercy and grace did to take care of our biggest problem. our sin problem that keeps us from consistently being good and able to even define it and able to even agree on it. Christmas is about that. So this great truth that we're celebrating this season, that God took on flesh and came down to rescue us, both frames and answers all the above questions we were asking. Why believe in a God? Because you can't be good for goodness sake. You can't. I can't. In fact, I want you to look at the problem this morning that you've got without God. I want you to look at the problem you've got without God. Turn with me in your Bibles to Psalm 53. Psalm 53. I want you to see the problem you've got without God. Psalm 53. And it says, the fool has said in his heart, there is what? No God. Now we could just park it right there and we could do a whole sermon on that sentence. But let me point out, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and a lot of the others that are making money with bestsellers now that are calling themselves the new atheist, kind of a new second wave. This verse says, the fool has said where? Just to say it in your heart, just to sit and think it, makes you a fool. These are men that are proclaiming it from the housetops, that are publishing it, printing it, going on talk shows, saying it. What's that make them? The fool just says it in his heart. And seriously, as I read Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great, the summer of my sabbatical, it made me ill, not just because I disagreed with what he was saying. I felt so sick for him. In thinking, this man is going to stand before God. To think that you would publish and write and title a book, God Is Not Great. And the book, along with Dawkins' The God Delusion, they're so venomous. They're not just politely and warmly wanting to philosophize a little bit and cause us to think. I just want to make you think for a minute. They're venomous. It's vitriolic. It's so harsh. And I'm thinking, you are going to stand before, as you write these, as you type these words, as you meet with your publisher and editor, the very God you're attacking and hating and spewing out all over is putting breath in your lungs. What a good God. Now be careful. I want to make sure you understand, the same is true for me. The same is true for you. We should be amazed that God keeps giving us breath and mercy and grace and goodness. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt and have done abominable iniquity. There is none, here we go, there is none who does what? Good. There's none who does good. God looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. Every one of them has gone out of the way. Every one of them has turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good. No, not one. Now, you're probably thinking, that sounds familiar, Brad, but I don't think you've ever had us turn to Psalm 53 and read that. Where else have we heard that? Where do you hear me quote that from? Romans chapter 3, Paul reaches back to the Old Testament, and this is the passage from which Paul is quoting when he talks in Romans 3 and is building his case, because Romans 1 through 3 is building a case for we are desperately depraved sinners before he begins to give the good news in Romans 4, 5, and 6 of salvation. But it started in Psalm 53. No, not one. None good. Now skip back to Psalm chapter 16, verse 1 and 2. Psalm chapter 16, verse 1 and 2. Preserve me, O God, for in you I put my trust. O my soul, you've said to the Lord, you are my Lord. Now look at this. My goodness is nothing apart from you. My goodness is nothing apart from you. Without God, we do have a problem. And listen, I want to make sure you understand, if you're thinking, yeah, maybe I've got a problem in the afterlife, but I don't care. I'll just deal with that when I get there. No, I'm today talking to you. You've got a problem. Without God, you have a problem now. Right here, right now, you've got a problem. difficulties right here, right now. Never mind what it's going to do to you in the afterlife, how that's going to affect you in the afterlife. Right here, right now, the problem touches you on so many different levels. If you don't believe me, I want to point out two, just two. There are more than two, but I want to point out two of the conundrums that you face in trying to live life without God. Here's the first. Trying to live life without God. Many people don't want God anymore, but they still want the safety net of a free-floating morality and justice. A lot of people now today don't want God. Why do they not want God? Because they want to live the way they want to live. But they really don't want to live in a world where everyone would actually do that. They would like for you to obey God and let them live any way they want. You see, it's very inconsistent. If everyone truly did what they're wanting to do, it would not work out. No one would get to do what they want to do. Lots of people would be murdered. Lots of people would be abused. Lots of people would be trampled across. So people don't want God anymore, but they still want the safety net of a free-floating morality and justice. It's like wanting to have your cake and eat it too. Both. So the new atheists, as they're calling themselves today, are working overtime to try to build a case for the fact that you can live a decent, moral, upstanding life without God, that you don't need God to be good. And here's the reason why they're working so hard on this. Here's the reason why Dawkins is emphasizing this, and Hitchens and Sam Harris and others. They have recognized that the average person, whether they walk into a church on Sunday morning or not, are afraid of living in the kind of world you would have if you follow atheism to its logical conclusion. All you have to do is watch CNN. All you have to do is pick up a history book, and you realize every nation that buys into there is no God, communism, and seeks to re-educate its people with little red scarves and teach everyone there is no God, there is no God, there is no God, there is no God. Can you name a communist country where communism came in and the country flourished from that point forward? The way they treat each other, human rights, the treatment of women, the productivity of that country and the way they do their work. Just the other day, I was talking to someone who had been in Romania, talking to some believers there who lived there during the communists when they were in power, and somehow they got off on work, and they said, yes, they pretended to pay us, and we pretended to work. That's where things devolve. All you have to do is read history and look at the atrocities that take place. I just finished reading a biography by a pastor in Romania. When the communists came in, the abuses began, the violation of human rights, not just against Christians. This is what was interesting to me as I read chapter after chapter. He testifies to all the people he got to witness to in the prisons with him. There were other communists. They kept doing each other wrong. The woman and the man that were in power when he got tossed into prison ended up in prison with him because someone else stabbed them in the back and wanted to get rid of them. It doesn't work. Once you throw out God and there's no ethics and no character and no standard, it's just whoever can do what they want in that moment. And everyone is dispensable. It was not just Christians in the prison. The prisons were loaded with other communist party members that had been leaders, and they were all just stabbing each other and taking over left and right. Mess. Total chaos. No God. No good. And Christians were the shining light in that situation. They were the only ones that had a reason to be good, to continue to hope and to have some standard of moral right and wrong. But see, back in the early 1900s, old school atheists, what we're facing today are the new school atheists, Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris and others, but old school atheists back in the early 1900s, like Nietzsche and Sartre and others, they were willing to admit the real deal on atheism. They were honest. They were bold. Because it was kind of like avant-garde. It was this new exciting thought, but they hadn't seen the ramifications of it played out yet. Now we've lived with it long enough that people have seen it. They're saying, whoa, 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 whoa. We need to start saying something else because people aren't going to go for this. But Nietzsche and Sartre and others, Nietzsche insisted that if God is dead, then any and all morality of love and human rights is baseless. That's what he said. And he was right. If God is dead, then any any and all morality of love and human rights is baseless. If God is dead, there can be no good reason for you to be kind, to be loving, or to work for peace. The late Yale law professor, Arthur Leff, admits the bind that atheists have put themselves in, he being one of them. He's talking about himself. So this is not a Christian now I'm about to quote to you. This is one of their own. And he said this, as a law professor, thinking through logically. He said, quote, "The fact is, if there is no God, then all moral statements are arbitrary." It's true. If there's no God and no standard from God, then all moral statements are arbitrary. All moral valuations are subjective and internal. And there can be no external moral standard by which a person's feelings and values are judged. So he recognizes the problem and does a great job articulating the problem. But then he ends this very intellectual essay that he was writing in a shocking way. He then says this at the end of his essay. "As things are now, everything is up for grabs. Nevertheless, napalming babies is bad. Starving the poor is wicked. Buying and selling each other is depraved. There is such a thing as evil. Altogether now, says who? God help us." That's how he ended his own essay. He recognized that something within him says, well, napalming babies is still bad. Buying and selling each other is depraved. Starving the poor is wicked. But says who? On what basis? God help us. And he wrote that in the 70s. That's the problem that sits in the laps of the atheist. I read article after article. I've got more stuff than I could ever put in this one sermon. But article after article where atheists themselves were admitting, who is still in Louisiana working in the aftermath of Katrina? They said it is by and large 98% Christians. Who's serving in so many of the most difficult places? It's Christians. Who starts most of the hospitals for the poor? It's Christians. Who digs wells for fresh water in most of the country? It's Christians. It's Christians. It's Christians. Why? There is a God. There is a standard of good and evil and more. And we have a reason for going and doing and being Christ. And so many times Vicky and I will say to each other on our bad days, when you just feel like we just keep getting pummeled and pummeled and pummeled by the world, we'll just say, I should stop saying will. I say it. She listens. I'll say, imagine one day, if just on one given day, God decided December 15th, Monday, December 15th, I'm going to remove every Christian and everything, activity and ministry and service that's being done by Christians, gone for a day. Now, I'm not saying there's no unbelievers doing anything nice, but folks, the world would be shocked, shocked. I read another article that said you don't find atheists and secular humanists serving in soup kitchens. These were humanists writing this. They said that you just don't, because there's no dignity and value in human worth. Everyone's looking out for themselves. They've drawn the conclusion, the logical conclusion of where this leads. So the problem that sits in the lap of the atheist is, says who? Why should I do anything other than grab all the gusto I can get? Why do anything different? But the new atheists want to hold on to good and to construct a system that defines and measures good without God. And they end up doing ridiculous things like what Dawkins does in his book, The God Delusion. In his book, The God Delusion, Dawkins gives a set of what he calls new Ten Commandments. A set of new Ten Commandments. I won't read them all, but let me give you a sampling of what they're like. Number one, commandment number one, do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you. That sounds so familiar. What? Gosh, he's smart. How did he think of that? Hello. Do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you. That is really good. Wonder. Number two, in all things, strive to cause no harm. Number three, treat your fellow human beings, your fellow living things, and the world in general with love, honesty, faithfulness, and respect. You know, it's hard to respect slime. It's hard to respect a collection of electrons. It's hard to respect just pure DNA. Respect someone else. Why? Why, Richard? Number four, do not overlook evil. or shrink from administering justice, but always be ready to forgive wrongdoing, freely admitted and honestly regretted. Sounds like I'm sitting in church. Sing a hymn, pass the plate. Now, I can't help but stop right there and wonder out loud. Always be ready to forgive. Based on what? Why? Now, let's be honest. Forgiveness is doggone hard with God in the picture. I mean, I'm a pastor. I meet with people who are struggling to forgive somebody, and I've got someone sitting in front of me that believes in God and says Jesus died for their sins. I've got some leverage. I've got a fulcrum that I keep whammying on them, saying, how can you not forgive in light of all that God's forgiven you? Imagine sitting with an atheist that says, there is no God, there is no Jesus, there's no cross, I've never been forgiven anything, but I'll forgive that guy that did me so wrong at work. Like, that's going to happen. Not ever, 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 ever. In fact, listen, the work of Christ on the cross and God's mercy and forgiveness towards us are the very legs that forgiveness stands on. When you cut those legs out from underneath forgiveness, when you cut out from underneath forgiveness that there is a God who sent his son to the cross to bear our sins and to forgive us for every and any infraction that we have ever committed, when you cut those legs out from underneath the feet of forgiveness, all you have left now is an impotent, paraplegic apology lying motionless on the ground. No power. With absolutely no power to change a heart or set someone free from the chains of bitterness. The cross of Christ makes forgiveness possible, powerful, and meaningful. Because see, the human heart, part of our struggle with forgiveness is like the human heart says, But how is this going to be made right? If I forgive, will there be justice? You look to the cross and say, absolutely there'll be justice. God is on his throne. He's going to take care of it. And think of what he's forgiven you of. There's a basis for this. Otherwise, we're just in the land of la-la. It's just pixie dust we're throwing around. It's just words. It's just a little abracadabra. I forgive you. I hope that makes you feel better. But we're just hanging in midair. We have our feet firmly planted in midair, standing on nothing. Now, those of you that have been hurt deeply by a parent or sexually abused or have experienced the pain of divorce, a treason, a broken trust, those of you that have been stabbed in the back at work and bypassed for a promotion, those of you, I could just go on and on and on. Without the foundation of there is a God of justice, he sees and he will make right, and he has forgiven me and set me free, that when I stand before him, I could hear, come into my presence, my son, my daughter. Without that, you can't forgive. You won't. You won't forgive. So who does Richard Dawkins think he's fooling, talking about forgiveness without God? It's like when I see these football players at the beginning of the games, you know, they're all together and they're hopping around saying, this is our house. We're in our house. We're not going to let them have us today. This is our house. When he starts talking about forgiveness, I want us to all hop in a circle. This is our house. He's talking about forgiveness. That's our stuff. You're in the land of God now. You're in the God zone. This is all God words. That's not your stuff. But see, the new atheists want to be over here without God and keep reaching over and dipping into the Christian barrel and saying, but we still want some of this stuff because there's tremendous benefits and fruits to living this way instead. We need all of you to do that while we do our own thing. This is God's stuff, forgiveness. You're solidly in the land of God. You've entered the heart. And so, in fact, when you talk about forgiveness, you have entered into the heart and soul of Christianity. The gospel. You've just parked yourself right in the presence of the gospel. Once you suck God out of the equation, human beings are just left parroting an empty, vacuous phrase. I forgive you. Which by and large, listen, apart from God in someone's life, and even apart from good biblical teaching in a good church, people just don't use the word I forgive. They apologize. But it's too late to apologize. We need forgiveness. They apologize. They say they're sorry. They say, don't worry about it. You actually have to be taught about forgiveness. It is not something that we naturally do. And if that's not bad enough, listen to the next one, number five. Live life with a sense of joy and wonder. You got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding. Now, I know why he says it. Guess why he writes it and says it? Because every human being wants to live life with a sense of joy and wonder. And they're finding that out since the early 1900s. They're realizing, good grief, no matter how much we try to stamp out God, people, doggone it, still seem to want a sense of joy and wonder in life. They don't want to just live life. Okay. Wake up every day and live life with a sense of wonder and joy for no reason. Because think about this. The person that wrote that represents a body of people that have been telling us now since the late 1800s and early 1900s that we emerged from slime. We have no more value, dignity, or worth than an aardvark or a houseplant. That we have no divine purpose or reason for living. That it's really just survival of the fittest. Tooth and claw is one of their favorite phrases. Tooth and claw. Survival of the fittest. But I'm supposed to wake up every day with a sense of joy and wonder. Well, I guess you could wake up joyful that someone else's tooth and claw didn't already take you out. And you can keep wondering why I'm here. Why am I here? There can be your joy and wonder. You can have joy that no one else has killed you yet. And you can wonder why you haven't killed yourself. Because you still don't know why you're here. Joy and wonder. Why? See, like it or not, atheism is bankrupt. Bankrupt when it comes to joy, wonder, purpose, peace, and meaning. But they keep wanting to dip their hand into the Christian barrel and pull out some of God's words and hang on to some of the fruits and the benefits of being created with purpose by a loving, personal creator who calls you by name, who wove you together in your mother's womb, who puts his spirit in you, and who would send his son, who would take on flesh and send his son both to live and die for you. Now that's something to wake up having joy and wonder about. God would do that for me. You mean I have purpose and meaning. I'm special. I'm unique. There is dignity and worth. God wove me together in my mother's womb. This didn't just happen. This wasn't just egg and sperm coming together just randomly and here I am. There was purpose and meaning. God had me in mind. Yes. I'm not just like a houseplant or a golden retriever. Yes. You're different. There's purpose and meaning. Yes. There's joy and wonder. You can keep wondering, why, God? Why would you do that for us? Why would you give yourself? Why would you step down into our mess? Why would you come down into our squalor and our filth? Why have you not already snuffed us out? Why do you forbear with us? Why do you give such mercy? Why do you continue to bless us like you do? See, the world tends to focus on God when something bad just happened. Where was God? As soon as I want to say to them, why aren't you asking where he is on every good day? Because your good days outnumber your bad days by far. But you can't have it both ways. If you don't want God, then you can't have good. If you don't want God, then you've just hamstrung yourself regarding how much joy, peace, and meaning you're going to be able to squeeze out of this life. Because apart from God, life degenerates very quickly down into sexual body functions, beer, sports, and just trying to grab all the gusto you can and hold on to your stuff longer than someone else can try to take it away from you. Without God, life degenerates quickly down. Now, if you think I'm being unfair, let me show you what Richard Dawkins has done to himself when he puts a list of new Ten Commandments in his latest book. And tries to preach a message of being good, doing right, causing no harm to other people. It is misleading, it is inconsistent, and it is completely contradictory to everything he's already written and preached and promoted. And that's the problem that the new atheist is facing today. They've been promoting this message of no God so long that guess what? Some people believe them and have started living the logical conclusions of that message. Generations of young people have bought into what they're being taught now, that you're nothing more than a collection of electrons with no soul, no eternal destiny, no worth, no value, just a bigger-brained animal. And sometimes that is questionable. And so the way many people are living to their lives today is catching up with Richard Dawkins and secular atheists. And they, listen to me, they don't want to take the blame. They don't want to take responsibility for the wake of moral confusion and chaos they have left behind them. It's their boat that's been cutting through our culture for 75 to 100 years now. It is their boat and their ideology that's leaving this wake. But now they're wanting to say, oh, no, it doesn't have to be that way. You can still be good. You can still be decent. You can still be moral and upstanding. Let me show you the inconsistency I'm talking about. In 1996, in one of his earlier books, Richard Dawkins said, and I quote, "In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no other good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music." Yeah, we got people dancing to the music of their own DNA, and they end up dancing all over someone else. That's what it leads to. Do you hear what he's saying? There is at the bottom of it all no good, no evil, no purpose, nothing but, and how do you like this value-added term? Blind, pitiless indifference. Now there is an honest explanation of where life without God leads you. That's honest. But see, that was 12 years ago. And now they're wanting to tweak this message because that has sent fear into the hearts of so many people. And they're beginning to see the consequences of some people believing it and acting out on that. So Dawkins and others now are starting to realize that they need to modify this message of atheism and no God. And what we're getting now is a kinder, gentler version. But it's a lie. They've already told us what they really believe when they talk about a blind, pitiless indifference that dances to the music of DNA. Listen, if we're all just strands of DNA like Christmas lights all tangled together, who cares whether you harm another strand of DNA or not? Who cares about justice? Just do what you want, get what you can, and get away with all you can. And that's how many people have started to live. And society is alarmed and say, oh my, we can't have people living like that. But it's the logical conclusion of what they've been preaching to us for so long. Blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. Only God can provide the security net and foundation of justice that the human heart longs for. Psalm 89 verse 14 says, "Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Mercy and truth go before your face." Psalm 33 verse 4 and 5 says, "For the word of the Lord is right. All his work is done in truth. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord." Basically, here's the deal. For the new atheist to come up with any sense of morality and justice requires them to ride on the coattails of, you guessed it, Christianity and God. But listen to me. The coattails of God are not enough. You need the God of the coat. You need the total package. You need the whole deal. You actually need God to be good. We can't do it consistently on our own. Joel McDermott explains it this way in his book, The Return of the Village Atheist. He says, good title too. He says, "Every normal person recognizes that we must have moral rules that transcend mere men. That is, rules that come from above and are truly authoritative in order for true freedom to exist. He who ignores these rules denies in principle the safeguard of human prosperity and invites tyranny." The village atheist cannot see this because he's blinded by his hatred of God. He thinks the existence of a sovereign God limits his freedom when in reality it is God who establishes it. Now, this is a very, very good argument. Track with him. If human rights are given to us by man, they can just as easily be taken away by man. You may praise the golden rule, but when you take God out from behind it, all morality loses its power. The atheist has no golden rule because the atheist has no golden ruler. The atheist has, in fact, a gold-plated rule. It has the appearance of morality stolen from religion, but a cold iron core. The gold will rub off eventually, and the truth of atheistic culture will tarnish history once again. Let me give you an illustration of what I'm talking about. Pastor Timothy Keller planted a church in Manhattan, of all places. And people told him it can't be done because he actually preaches the Bible. He's reformed. He's biblical counseling, Nuthetic biblical counseling. He's everything you're not supposed to be if you want to grow a big mega church. And God has brought people in New York City that have been hungry for the truth. Well, he tells a story, he gets this a lot, he said, of a young couple who came to see him. And he's very gracious. He has a wonderful manner if you listen to him. And God is using him mightily. He tells of a couple who came to see him to ask him about life, who did not believe that there was a God. I'll let you hear him tell it himself. A young couple once came to me for spiritual direction. They didn't believe in much of anything, they said. How could they begin to figure out if there even was a God? I asked them to tell me about something they felt was really, really wrong. Well, the woman immediately spoke out against practices that marginalized women. I said I agreed with her fully since I was a Christian who believed God made all human beings. But I was curious why she thought it was wrong. She responded, "Women are human beings and human beings have rights. It's wrong to trample on someone's rights." I asked her how she knew that. Puzzled, she said, "Everyone knows it is wrong to violate rights of someone." I said, "Most people in the world don't know that. They don't have a Western view of human rights. Imagine if someone said to you, 'Everyone knows that women are inferior.' You'd say, 'That's not an argument, it's just an assertion,' and you'd be right." I said, "So let's start again. If there's no God as you believe and everyone just evolved from animals, why would it be wrong to trample on someone's rights?" Well, her husband spoke up and said, "Yes, it's true, we're just bigger brained animals, but I'd say animals have rights too. You shouldn't trample on their rights either." So I asked him whether he held animals guilty for violating the rights of another animal if the stronger ones ate the weaker ones. He said, "No, I couldn't do that." So I said, "You just hold human beings guilty if they trample on the weak." He said, "Yes." I said, "Why the double standard? Why did the couple insist that human beings had to be different from animals so that they were not allowed to act as was natural to the rest of the animal world? Why did the couple keep insisting that humans had this great, unique, individual dignity and worth? Why did they believe in human rights?" "I don't know," the woman said. "I guess they're just there, that's all." Well, why they're there is because God put his law in our hearts, Romans chapter 2 says. And because we know we're created in his image, he put eternity in our hearts. There's something different about us. You ought to feel awkward and there ought to be some uncomfortableness in abusing an animal, even that. But when it comes to another human being, apart from a hardening of a heart, you just know this is wrong. I guess they're just there, that's all. He says this conversation reveals how our culture differs from all the others we've gone before. People still have strong moral convictions, but unlike people in other times and places, they don't have any visible basis for why they find some things to be evil and other things good. It's almost like their moral intuitions are free-floating in midair, far off the ground. Let me point out a second conundrum quickly as we close. Without God, you don't just struggle to make right choices. You'll struggle to make sense out of life. The problem's bigger than just your decision-making process. You will struggle to make sense out of life because we all have this gnawing urge for significance, that something for something greater than just eating and breathing and sleeping and reproducing, because we were created in the image of God, who is the center and source of all significance. Cats, butterflies, aardvarks don't spend any other time thinking about significance. I've never heard of a golden retriever committing suicide because he was struggling with, "Where am I going? Who am I? Why am I here?" I mean, they get hit by cars because they're wanting to bite the tire, but not because they wanted to give their own life, you know. This is it. I can't live like this anymore. I'm just lying on this porch. I'm just wagging my tail. I'm just eating, pooping, reproducing. It's not enough. I need more. He throws himself out in front of that Jeep. No. No. They don't. They don't. They're happy as can be. Think about this. Despair and depression are unique to the human race precisely because we are unique and we need more. We have a soul that yearns for more, that longs for more, that hopes for more. We need more than just living, breathing, reproducing, dying. And when that sense of being created uniquely in the image of God is ripped from the fabric of our being, along with it goes hope and purpose and meaning. Animals don't worry about whether life's worth living. They just live life. But when you and I start waking up like animals to just live life, we die. Because just living's not enough. You were made for more. You know you were made for more. Your soul cries out for more. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27, God said, "Let us make man in our own image. According to our likeness, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now there's dignity and worth and value and purpose. And so we're going to struggle if you start living on such a low level of raw naturalism because our souls long for more. So let go of your faulty premise that there is no God. Bow the knee to the Savior, King Jesus. The philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said that God is silent, I cannot deny. That everything within me cries out for God, I cannot forget. That's because Ecclesiastes 3:11 says that he's made everything beautiful in his own time and he's placed eternity in their hearts. Eternity. Before he died, Bertrand Russell, an atheist, was asked, "Mr. Russell, when you die, what if you're wrong? And when you stand before God, what would you say to him?" And he answered, "I would tell God, you did not give me enough evidence. You just did not give me enough evidence." Folks, no, you won't. You won't say that. You won't say that because it's not true. The problem of unbelief with the human heart is not a lack of evidence. It's suppressing the evidence that we have. Romans 1, 18 to 22 says, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who do what? Suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them," because God has made it plain to them, "for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful. So they became futile in their minds, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools." Now, I don't want us to roar out of here gloating in an arrogant way and looking down on those that don't believe in a God. You ought to go out of here crawling, amazed that if it were not for God having enlightened your heart, burst through your darkness and your hardness and your pride, you would be buying the bestsellers, reading them, quoting them, and trying to believe it and live it. We are here by the mercy of God. The passage that Brad Spence read to us, "But in the kindness of God, when God our Savior in his kindness appeared to us, not by works of righteousness which we would have done, but according to his" what? "Mercy, he saved us." God, we thank you today for your mercy. Thank you that first of all, God is. You are. And secondly, God is good. And that is our only hope for being good ourselves. Thank you. Apart from you, our goodness is nothing. Thank you for the goodness of Christ and the cross and the resurrection and the hope that we have. We give you thanks. Shine through us. Live through us. Use us for your glory, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.